Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, reminding you that we have Zoomed the day before. We begin every show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I told you that I wanted you to hear his voice in your head as you exercise the franchise, whether you vote in person, whether you vote by mail, whether you vote absentee, you of course are going to vote. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Joining us as he does every Friday, which is why I've got a big smile on my face, if you could only see me on Zoom, we are joined by Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is affectionately known as the Voice of Texas. He is the editor of the Quorum Report. He is the dean of the Austin Press Corps. He is someone who has taught me so much about Texas politics, Texas history, Texas food, Texas economics. I just need to let you know something the other day. So I'm commenting with someone. I'm talking to a professor. He goes, how do you know so much about my state? And I'm just going, oh, I have the best teacher. And it was you, darling. Anyway, there's so much going on. But I wanted to start with what just happened this week. We now hear that basically they have scrapped the RNC convention.
Yeah, aren't they just going to hold it at the White House?
Yeah, everything's going to be on the front
line. Didn't the president just say he was going to hold it at the White House and do his acceptance speech in the Oval Office and have a few people over the Rose Garden and they could, have a little party there?
It's unbelievable. Remember, we started in North Carolina, then we moved to Florida, then we moved back to North Carolina. Yep. Now we're on the front lawn of the White House. And the reason why I'm kind of laughing about this is that I remember all the shadoo in Texas where you were holding your Republican convention about how everyone's like, oh, we have to meet in person. Oh, And then they ultimately, despite a lot of ticked off human beings, ended up doing virtually a completely online Republican convention. They must be looking at what Donald Trump is doing and going, and we fought so hard. We put our necks on the line about doing something in person because we thought we were taking the lead from Donald Trump. Yep. Donald Trump just shafted you guys. I just want to let you know. He pulled the rug out from under you because he's going to be doing something that's virtually online.
He says he may do his speech from the White House, although I saw his chief of staff, Mark Meadows, say that it would not be from the Oval Office. I saw him say that on CNN, and that it could be from the East Wing, which is the residence, which I think there's still some question about that. Senator John Cornyn, our senior senator in Texas, had said it would be problematic for the president to have any kind of a political event at the White House. It's just not appropriate. And you heard other Republicans say that too. And it was the second time in a week that Republicans quickly broke with the president on something. Didn't you see last week, I think it was after we talked, that the president had said that maybe they should delay the election because we can't be sure this mail-in voting isn't going to be, a big fraud and that it'll be rigged and all of that. And very conservative Republicans from Texas quickly said, no, sir, that's not even something you should think about, changing the date of the election, not to mention the fact that the president cannot unilaterally do that. But yeah, we had this big fight in Texas over whether to have an in-person convention.
Right.
And it might just be the assumption of a lot of people in this audience. I know that your audience skews more liberal and a bunch of Democrats, Arnie. It might be the assumption that Republicans just all want to have an in-person event, but that's not true. And I'm starting to think that this coronavirus, that this pandemic is really fracturing even the base for President Trump because here's what's going on. you do have a lot of them who will say that it's the fake news and that, you know, that it's just a hoax and it's not real. The coronavirus really isn't that bad. The pandemic isn't that bad. And so we should be, you know, we should be able to go on and have our events in person, and we shouldn't have to worry about these masks and all this other stuff. But that's not borne out by their actual behavior. And when I was covering the big fight over whether to have this Republican convention in Texas in person or online, it wasn't Republicans fighting Democrats about whether to do it online. It was Republicans fighting each other about whether to do it online.
Exactly. As the
State Republican Executive Committee was debating it in marathon emergency meetings, I think I listened to 16 hours of it or more over the course of a week and a half, what became apparent was Republicans from all parts of the state, from West Texas, out in the Panhandle, Lubbock area, Amarillo, Abilene, South Texas and the coastal band of Corpus Christi and those areas, everywhere in between, Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, at least half of those people who were set to be Republican delegates for their state convention, at least half were not going to go to Houston where the in-person convention had been scheduled. Then I heard from a lot of folks who got elected at the Republican Party of Texas convention to be national delegates.
Governor Abbott, remember?
Well, Governor Abbott.
Didn't he say he wasn't going to lead the delegation to North Carolina?
Well, that's correct. He said that he wrote a letter to the head of the RNC and said that the pandemic, that's a serious matter.
Exactly.
He said that the pandemic was, you know, his top priority right now, and he would not be able to attend a political event in the middle of all this. I do think there's also a health concern for the governor, who is immunocompromised. He's a person who is in a wheelchair. He's, I believe he's 62 years old, and he's been in that wheelchair for decades, as you know, since he was a young man. Yeah. And a tree fell on him in Houston and crippled him. It put him in that wheelchair. He was in the ICU for a couple of months. He said that he was going to allow for our lieutenant governor, the little governor, Dan Patrick, to instead lead the delegation to North Carolina. Patrick, who also has some health concerns, he's 70, and he had a health scare in the last couple of years. He had a heart situation, which his office did not describe as a heart attack, but that is the suspicion. He did have to have a procedure done. I did see him at an event in Dallas a little while after that happened. You know how after somebody has a heart attack, how their whole body sort of, you can tell that they've gone through something very traumatic. He looked that way. And so anyway, I would be concerned about his health as well. But he's headed to North Carolina to lead the Texas delegation. And this is just a reality now that people can't be having these giant in-person events, what they call these super spreader events. And no matter what the president might want to do, what kind of image he might want to project, the pandemic just is not allowing for it.
So are they still going to do anything in North Carolina, or are they all
sure
going to like stand? I mean, it's,
I'm not even sure what
chaos.
It's supposed to be. It is
exactly,
kind of chaotic.
Exactly.
Like, why are they even going?
Chaotic.
Why are they even
going? Exactly.
I mean, you mentioned and we talked about the Republican Party of Texas convention. It was a disaster online as far as them trying to do their business. They had a voting system online that melted down and was cyber attacked and all of this. And, and even in the midst of the convention, you had delegates who were saying, wait, let's stop this online crap and let's go in person. This is just really ridiculous. So the debate never ends. As far as exactly what they're going to do, I'm not sure. I mean, they don't have a contested primary, right? I mean, it's not like they have to sort out. It's not, and of course, the conventions aren't what they used to be, right, Arnie, where there would actually be business that would happen at these things. It's a big party, right? It's energy. It's basically a 4 or 5 day commercial for each of the parties. Mm-hmm. The Democrats do their version of it. The Republicans
to juice the base
version of it. It gets the base charged up. And of course, for the president, he really needs that to have the base charged up.
So
one of the things I would say about the president, very interesting. There was a story published after the rally in Tulsa. Trump and one of his advisors, may have been Jared Kushner, but Trump and one of his advisors, they were talking about the fact that, the audience responds when Trump says certain things. And he's kind of like a stand-up comic testing out material. Like, he goes to these rallies and he wants to be able to do an an acceptance speech because he wants to test his lines live in front of people. That's how he knows how he's getting the base riled up, is if, you know, he says, you know, build the wall, you know, do they go crazy for that? Or is that kind of getting old? And
is that yesterday?
When he starts to say lock her up or whatever, do they still get charged up about that? I mean, if he
Benghazi,
Benghazi, if he calls him, but I'll show you since we're on this, the listeners can't see it, but it's, this is the Benghazi.
Here's a Benghazi button, everyone. You're so funny.
That I got at a Republican convention.
You'll have to send that to me so I can post it on Facebook.
I miss Republican conventions because this is the kind of swag that you, the kind of flair that you pick up. So, but anyway, he tests these things out, right? If he's calling him Sleepy Joe in the speech and the audience really reacts to that, he knows to keep doing it. And when he doesn't have this opportunity to interact live with people, he's sapped of his energy. He doesn't know, you know, which lines are working and what's, you know, what's really going to work on social media and in his videos, et cetera.
He's a very visual. He wants to smell it, touch it, and see it. He can't read. The Zoom won't be useful. Doing something online doesn't connect with him because he's basically a Luddite. He doesn't do, you know, any of these things. But you were mentioning that Republicans now are beginning to realize they don't want to have in-person things. Republicans are beginning to embrace masks. There was a hilarious, you guys, Andy Borowitz headline that I posted on Facebook. And this is the headline from Andy Borowitz. Remember, this is a comedy article. Borowitz writes, Biden leading Trump among voters who favor being alive. And as you were talking, that's what I was thinking. You're seeing this sort of come to mask moment with Republicans. You're seeing come to socially distance moment with Republicans. And it is, they're beginning to realize that they want to be alive too.
Mask hysteria.
Because no matter what Trump is saying, they're beginning to recognize that what he is saying is not going to keep them safe. And ultimately safety is important to them.
It's the same people who post MAGA, and you know, they talk about the Democrats are, you know, basically creating some kind of a hoax, and as soon as November 4th rolls around, the virus will just magically go away. Those same exact people don't want to be around anybody who isn't close family right now, and if anybody, you know, walks into their office place,
they're the first times a day.
They'll get tested, and they're the first ones to Lysol the whole place as soon as anybody who they're not familiar with leaves the room.
So I want to talk about schools. Because you actually have two stories that you want to talk about. One is Governor Abbott says it'll be up to school boards around Texas to decide whether schools are open. That's totally appropriate. Meantime, this is the one I adored. Meantime, nearly 40% of Texas teachers are eligible for retirement today and could just walk out if they do not want to be exposed to coronavirus in a classroom. That nugget is so powerful. And it touches me personally. My sister-in-law just retired from teaching. She pulled the trigger. So what you are describing is exactly what she did. So let's talk a little bit about how schools are reacting and what does that mean, especially in a place where there is a huge technological divide. Because not coming into school, I understand, but teaching remotely means in certain, especially poor rural areas, how are they going to learn? What's going to be their vehicle for accessing information and teaching?
Schools, this is the big question, Arnie, and I do think that this is going to potentially be the thing that moves the election one way or the other, because you're talking about your money, you're talking about your kids. People are wondering exactly which way state and federal leadership and local leadership, which way they're going to go on all this. And in Texas, there are, I think about, and I was pulling the numbers up for you because I want to have it right. There are about 360,000 teachers all across Texas. 130,000 of those are retirement age. They could just hand in their paperwork tomorrow and they would be good to go. Now, I will say, there's a difference between being eligible for retirement and being able to afford retirement. So there are a lot of teachers who are not going to do that. But anecdotally, I did hear from teachers all over the state who had said that they're sort of quietly talking about this with their families. They don't want to be exposed to coronavirus. They could go ahead and take their retirement and walk out. I do think that the education groups, the teacher groups, probably do have a bigger stick in this situation than leadership would like. The governor, the lieutenant governor, the speaker of the House, the chairman of the public education committees in both the Texas House and Texas Senate did try to make clear last week that the ultimate decision on this rests with the locally elected school boards all across Texas, which is about 1,200 school districts from north to south, to east to west. And what's that going to mean? when they're all coming up with a different way of doing this. So if the Dallas Independent School District does something different from the Houston Independent School District, and the little school districts out in places like West Texas, you know, where they don't have very many students and they don't have a big outbreak or anything, if they want to move forward, that's one thing. Right now, it looks like they're being offered some flexibility. Now,
offered money? And the reason I'm asking you this, you know, everyone's waiting for the feds to cut a check, but is the state going to sort of belly up to the bar? Because if you're going to offer people flexibility, some of this flexibility costs extra cash. Are they going to actually see the state supporting some of these decisions being made by these school boards with some additional funding for them to make a wise and funded decision?
These schools will be fully funded for up to 8 weeks if they decide to be online rather than in person. And the governor this week tried to make clear that individual school districts can apply for waivers beyond that to continue to get full funding. Okay. If they're not in person, on a case-by-case basis, the Texas Education Agency would consider that. So it looks like they're trying to offer as much flexibility as possible. But I would go back to the beginning of the pandemic, Arnie, and we're seeing a pattern with this, and this is what I want to point people to. At the beginning of the pandemic, as we talked about, it was local officials, county judges and mayors who were making the big decisions, the consequential decisions about shutting down giant events. The biggest one, of course, was South by Southwest in Austin, which is about a $330 million event. That's how much in economic output it means for Austin and the surrounding areas in the state. Rodeo Houston and the State Fair of Texas, these things were being shut down by local officials. Then when the governor decided it was time to open things back up, remember, he said he was removing their authority to make those decisions and he would make all those decisions himself. And so those initial decisions to shut things down were not thought to be politically popular, although in hindsight, they look like pretty good decisions because for a while, Austin, Houston, and these areas did not become the big coronavirus hotspots, although they later did after the governor had made the decision to open things back up without at first mandating that people wear masks, and then he did it 180 on that.
You can actually almost look at a graph and point to his decision and then the spike in the number
of numbers,
cases.
And then the numbers
go up. Oh, my God. Use that graph, everyone. Archie.
Well, that's right. And now that we're up against the school year about to start this month, the governor, once again, after at first deferring to local officials, county judges and mayors on those, quote, unpopular decisions. Then he took all of the responsibility on himself to make the decisions about opening Texas back up. And now that it's time to open school, he is saying, that's not up to me. That's up to the locally elected school boards to figure that out. One of the things that was controversial last week, the indicted Attorney General Ken Paxton, I know you love that. He had put out an opinion saying that county health departments essentially would not be able to preemptively close schools in Texas. So you wouldn't have city or county health authorities be able to just say blanketly that schools can't open and they have to be online instead or do something else, figure it out on their own. The Attorney General said that those authorities can shut schools down after the fact. If there's evidence of an outbreak in a school district at a high school or at a middle school or an elementary or whatever, then the county health authority could step in and shut them down. He was saying they can't do it preemptively. The governor held a press conference in San Antonio this week where he was asked point blank by I don't even know who asked it. I was just very amused by this reporter. Kind of got in his face and said, well, you know, shouldn't we trust a doctor rather than you about what, you know, is good for people's health? And, you know, the governor again kind of said, no, listen, this decision isn't up to me. It's up to locally elected school boards. Now, I do think that that may be the best thing, Arnie. The people who are elected to their school boards and their communities know what their community's values are and how they want, and they're very responsive to the people in their communities. I mean, they're going to see those people at the grocery store and at church if they're brave enough to be going right now during the pandemic. And so they're going to get an earful about this. And, if people don't want their kids to go back, then they're not going to go back in those places. I can tell you this is a real struggle. And I made this point on a conservative talk show earlier this week. Some people treat school like it's daycare, right? You know, the kids.
Well, the business community does. Let me just say that the business community sees schools as daycare, and they need that because they want the stability.
Well, I don't agree with that. Well, let me tell you why I don't agree with that. Because there are absolutely some people who treat it like it's daycare. You're not wrong about that. What I would say is that people need some kind of a structure. People need a day that is structured for two big reasons. One, people need to be able to schedule so that they, women need to be able to go to work, mm-hmm. men need to be able to go to work, and they want to know that their kid is in a place where they're being taken care of and getting an education. That helps undergird the current economy, right? And if you have a quality education happening, that also is an investment in the future of the economy, because you want to make sure those kids are educated and they can join the workforce. So I do think that, yes, some people treat it like daycare. I think it's a little more nuanced to say that you're bolstering both the current economy and the future economy by providing a quality public education to kids.
So I have to touch on this story just because my eyes are rolling. Lieutenant Governor
Little Governor
is looking at the spike in gun sales. And he says, because of the spike in gun sales, he says that is a sign, I'm not sure from where, that Trump is going to win.
Probably God.
So connect the dots between guns, bullets, spike, and Trump in Dan Patrick's head. I want to try to understand the roadmap of his mind.
We always set the tone in Texas, and we'll see if the president echoes this same sort of sentiment. The lieutenant governor has previously said things that end up coming out of Trump's mouth later, because it's sort of like a trial balloon. He is Trump's man in Texas. We've had, one poll after another that shows a competitive race between Joe Biden and President Trump in this state, which is problematic for Republicans. But, of course, Biden is leading in polls all across the country and in some key swing states, including President's home state of Florida, where he's now, the transplant. Also in North Carolina and some other places that Republicans generally could have counted on before. And so we've seen all these polls, but, of course, the little governor and others say that those polls are fake. And Patrick issued a statement from his campaign in his capacity as the chair of the Trump Texas Victory campaign. He said that more than 2.3 million guns were sold in June, which is a 145% increase from the prior year. And then he went into some numbers. And he said that, quote, people who buy guns don't vote for Democrats who are going to take them. Let's break this down. There's one poll after another that shows that Biden is either competitive or leading the president. So the chair of the Trump campaign in Texas, Dan Patrick, is going to say something to try to counter that and give the base, some reason to be excited about. I can tell you that independent polling and internal polling from different campaigns earlier in the state, most of the Trump base will not even countenance the idea that he might lose. So they're looking for anything to sort of back up they already think. So he's throwing this out there. We do know that people are buying record numbers of guns. And what's going on in the country? You have, once again, it just like always happens with certain folks during certain crises, you try to scare everybody. There's a one-block radius in Portland, Oregon, where if you talk to Trump supporters, they will act like the whole country is going to look like that one block in Portland if Joe Biden is elected. And this is a terrible position for an incumbent president to be in, because on the economy, on the pandemic, on the civil unrest, the argument across all of those is, yeah, it's bad, but it'll be that much worse if you elect that guy. With the challenger is in the position of saying, I'll fix it, right? I'll do better than him. And that would be, and it's not a partisan statement either, that's always the dynamic when you have an incumbent who's facing serious headwinds, right? So, and the challenger gets to play the part of picking apart their performance and saying what they would do instead, without having to have the albatross around their neck of what the actual consequences of their own decisions would be.
So New Hampshire is the home of Sturm Ruger. Sturm Ruger is producing more guns than they've ever produced in their history. They can't keep up with the demand for guns and bullets and yada, yada, yada. And so it's not just a Texas story. It's a national story. Okay.
Of course.
Sale of guns has gone through the roof. But let me just share something with you. No. Let me just share something with you. Here's the kicker. Are these new people buying guns for the first time, or are the same people adding to their arsenal under their bed? And what we have found out over and over again, it isn't that we're expanding the number of people that are actually buying weapons. There might be a few. There's no question about it. But the vast majority of weapons that are now being sold today are being sold to people who, in fact, are actually already owning, like 1,000 different kinds of guns, and they're just adding to this repertoire. And the other thing I just want to ask Dan Patrick, so is buying a gun about killing the COVID virus? Is buying a gun about threatening Biden voters? What does buying a gun have to do with Trump winning, other than they perceive it as their threat?
Well, think of it this way. The uptick in the sale of guns usually happens, at least in the last decade to 15 years, usually happens when the Democrat is about to win, because there are a lot of people who irrationally fear that the government is going to move to take away their guns. So they need to stock up now on both their ammo and their guns. So that, and then, of course, you know, for our entire lifetimes, whatever happens, nothing, nothing happens. It's just, the only thing that happens is what you said, which is the sales of Ruger and Smith & Wesson and all that. It goes through the roof. If you want to make money in the stock market, Arnie, just anytime a Democrat is about to win the presidency, you think so, just go ahead and buy some gun stock, because it is going to go up.
All right. And on that stock tip, we are going to say goodbye to Scott
Lock,
Braddock.
Stock, and barrel.
There you go. Lock, stock, and barrel. We're going to say goodbye to Scott Braddock. He is the editor of the Quam Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. If it is Friday, it must be Braddock. All right, everyone, stick around. We'll be right back with his WGBH mug. Sean Kay shows me all the swag. All right, everyone, stick around.
Gardens growing clean water on this current cast. When it rains, the runoff picks up pollution. Fertilizers, herbicides, and oils are carried across hard surfaces, through drains, and into our rivers, lakes, and oceans. Now people are creating rain gardens, directing storm water runoff to shallow depressions in the landscape where it's held long enough to seep into the ground. Pollutants are filtered out or broken down as they move through the soil and into the groundwater supply. With native plants, a rain garden can be a beautiful, low-maintenance, and low-cost way to attract birds and butterflies, too. Your garden may start in the gutter, but it can end up bringing clean water and new life to the land. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
This is the Friday edition of the Attitude Par Deux with my producers, Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Every other week, we hang out with Stefan Schmidt. Stefan Schmidt is affectionately known as Dr. Politics. He's a professor of political science at Iowa State. The two of us have been doing this sort of dog and pony show political style for over two decades. So we know each other well, and we've been covering so many, many campaigns. But of course, as Stefan knows, this is unique on every level. You know, we thought 2016 was something we had never seen before. 2020 is going to make 2016 look like a walk in the park. So let me welcome Stefan Schmidt back to the program. How are you, Stefan?
I'm good, thank you. And you're absolutely right. I mean, unprecedented. Every day something new breaks that is shocking. And the response of the federal government and President Trump in particular is inappropriate. I mean, the latest was a giant explosion in Beirut. And President Trump says, you know, it's basically an attack. And everybody said, it's not an attack. It was probably an accident. And saying it's an attack inflames the situation in Beirut and in Lebanon in ways that it shouldn't. Instead of saying, what can we do to help you? Can we send you some medical supplies? Can we send you some rescue teams? Which right. is what every
French are doing that.
President
yeah, yeah.
has done, right?
I am going to say this. He is now, and this is hard for me to say, but he is now actually the murderer in chief. Because what he is doing with Beirut, actually just add, it's already unstable to start, Stefan. There was already such chaos anyway. And then what he does is feed people who are going to begin to blame the government for things that are not true. And they get to point to the president of the United States making a statement saying he talked to his generals. And the generals are going, which general? We don't know what he's talking about. I mean, they're even doing the backstroke away from him. They're trying to figure out, you know, what is it? Kentucky Colonel, you know, Kentucky Fried Chicken, the Colonel. But he's not talking to a general. It is just, and then when you see what he says, Facebook, okay? Facebook just took down a video of Donald Trump where he put out misinformation about kids and going back to school.
Yes.
This is the same Facebook whose fact checkers looked at a Donald Trump ad and said virtually everything in the ad was false. But Facebook continued to run the ad because it's a political ad and they will not challenge political ads, okay? So even as they just did this like 48 hours before, they are now forced to take down a Trump video because he's putting out misinformation about children just the time as they're going back to schools. And even Facebook had to take it down. It was just unconscionable. And Donald Trump goes after Facebook. I just want everyone to realize how horrific this is. And let me just make one other point. And that is, Stefan, when I saw that Facebook's own fact checkers said that Donald Trump's ad is basically deceit, it's a lie, but they continue to run it because it's an ad. It's a political ad. What I wanted the Democratic Party to do is to buy an ad that followed every time Donald Trump's ads come up that are, in fact, have been checked and have been proven to be a lie, and say, you see the ad you just saw from Donald Trump? Fact checkers at Facebook have actually even said that this ad is basically a deceitful and a lie. Because Facebook is so wedded to profits, they're going to run this ad knowing it's a lie. You need to know this because you have to ask Facebook, why are you promoting deceit and lies to undermine this country? And just literally, and they have to run that ad because you're responding to Donald Trump's political ad. That's actually pointing out what Facebook is doing because it's more wedded to profits than to the facts.
Well, it's true. That will not change the mind of supporters of Donald Trump.
Oh, no.
Because a friend of mine sent me a text message and said, the supporters of Donald Trump are like ticks that have buried into the skin. You can't remove them. They're in there. They will not change their mind regardless of what happens. But the general public does seem in every poll to be essentially thinking differently, thinking more clearly. And the poll numbers that President Trump says, oh, those are fake numbers, you know, and so on. More and more people are saying no, they're really very solid. They're huge. Much bigger than what happened in 2016 when there were small variations in some states that gave President Trump the electoral votes. This time around, the polls really are overwhelming. I think President Trump has tried unsuccessfully to reach out to groups that are basically abandoning him.
Yeah.
Certainly suburban people are, suburban women are. He's not going anywhere with any minority votes, which was a fantasy that, you know, the Republicans said we're going to try to outreach to Latino voters, Hispanics, Black voters. And that I think is going to really not work out at all. So the base is there, but the base really may not be enough and won't be probably enough in 2020, unless the polls make Democrats feel so confident that he is going to lose that they won't vote in enough numbers. That's a big
risk. So they've been disabused of that from 2016. They've learned their lesson. They saw what happened in 2018 when they showed up in droves and they really began to, and they changed numbers everywhere. You're seeing just huge turnouts in primaries, yes, especially on the Democratic side. And that's an indication and sort of a bellwether for what's going to happen in November. And I will tell you that Donald Trump, on the whole issue of masks, now more and more Republicans are embracing the idea of masks in a way that is just sort of it is the opposite of everything Donald Trump is saying. And then Donald Trump is sending out that mixed message about mail-in voting and absentee balloting, because now he's saying it's good in Florida, but nowhere else. I'm going to sue this state for doing it, but I'm going to embrace Florida where I live because this is what I'm going to be doing. And so here's what I thought everybody should do, Stefan. I think all the states should say, hi, this is Missouri, this is Nevada, this is New York, also doing business as Florida, so that we all become Florida for the purposes of voting, since Donald Trump is embracing absentee balloting in Florida. Then if it's good for Florida, it's good for the other 49 states. But he's getting himself so contorted into a pretzel that as a Republican, what do you run on? What's your theme? Because he keeps changing the theme every 30 seconds.
Well, you run on anti-abortion, gun ownership, as you mentioned with Scott Braddock. You know, gun owners are always panicked about Democrats winning. You can't run on fiscal responsibility because the government has had to spend so much money, and the Republicans and Trump cut taxes. So the revenue stream has been basically starved, at the same time that the only thing that is keeping the economy from totally collapsing is borrowing and spending. And so they
You're wrong. You know what's keeping the economy from imploding? The extra $600 a week in unemployment benefits. Because unlike giving the rich a tax cut, they don't spend that money. They send that money to the Cayman Islands. But when you give a person who is unemployed an additional $600 a week, you know what they do? They pay their food bill. They pay their electric bill. They pay their rent. That's the irony of all this, is that what is keeping the economy afloat is that extra $600.
And the Republicans are, as you said, also in a pretzel, because they realize that. And at the same time, they're also panicked because they're no longer the party of fiscal responsibility and balanced budgets and so on. And so they're essentially now spending more than any Democratic administration ever has spent. At the same time that they still, on their party platform and the supposed philosophy, is fiscal responsibility. It must be horrible to be a Republican.
Well, I would love to be inside the brain of Mitch McConnell. Yeah. Because Mitch McConnell now has basically walked away from whatever the negotiations are for the next bailout, because he has decided not to listen to the crazies in his Senate, okay, the Tea Party folks who don't want to cut another check. Yeah. And he has basically said, whatever Trump and the Democrats have decided, I will go along with. I mean, what does that tell you? It tells you two things. One, he's doing the math too. And he realizes how important these unemployment checks are. And he's scared about Kentucky. He's afraid he might not get reelected, because Kentucky is a place where people are so economically vulnerable before the pandemic that with this unemployment and this cutting of these checks, he could lose because his fingerprints would be all over it. So his decision to do the backstroke and walk away speaks more about his vulnerability in November than it does with whatever his ideology is, because he understands people will retaliate. And if he actually tried to oppose this, they would pin it on him.
Arnie, I don't understand much about Kentucky. I don't know much about their politics. Is he going to have an opponent who will effectively remind people of this? Because people are really busy, especially now in all this chaos that's going on. You have to remind people of what's going on, what's important, who's doing what. And so the Democrats need to make sure that they, I know that in Florida, the Democrats apparently have done a tremendous job of registering people and getting them ready to vote by mail, which is why President Trump is freaked out and the Republicans are very panicked in Florida because they're way behind because President Trump has said it's not good to vote by mail. So is that true in Kentucky as well?
So Amy McGrath is the person who won the primary, and it was a very hotly contested primary, and she almost lost. But she is sitting on a mountain of cash. She has run before, so she has name familiarity. They have a Democratic governor in Kentucky. So I think they're going to spend a lot of money, and every time anything bad happens, they're going to make it, you know, Moscow Mitch will be responsible for making everything that's bad in Kentucky his fault. I mean, I'm just going to tell you right now, it's just amazing. But what is also amazing is to see what happened in Missouri, because in Missouri, you saw the progressives doing incredibly well against a Democrat who was an institution in Missouri. In addition to which, I'm pretty sure I'm correct here, Missouri passed the expansion of Medicaid. So you've got this opportunity now where people are beginning to sort of realize they can't trust the politicians to deliver what they need. They needed expanded Medicaid. If you're not going to do it, we're going to do it by referendum. When you look at the, you know, increase in minimum wage, whether it's a red state or a blue state, guess what? In every single state where there's been a referendum on increasing the minimum wage, it is one in a red state or a blue state. When you're looking at legalizing marijuana, it doesn't matter what state you're in, whether it's a red state or a blue state. You're seeing this idea that direct democracy now is the only way you're going to get what you need because the politicians have sold out.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying is so fascinating because it basically moves people's decision-making away from ideology, left, right, Democrat, Republican.
Exactly.
Moves it to pragmatic decisions about things that make a difference in their daily life. And that, I think, you know, is really interesting.
I wanted to touch on this for a couple of reasons. So I saw a tweet this morning and I posted it on Facebook and I sent it to you. And it was about Remdesivir. And this is how it begins. Highway robbery. Listen, everyone. Remdesivir, made by Gilead Sciences, has now set the price of the cost of $2,300 to $3,100 per patient. This is something that has been shown to work in people that are acutely ill from COVID-19. Right. I also want to remind you that Fauci is connected to Remdesivir. I believe he has some kind of either financial connection or been on the board. So I want someone to talk to Dr. Fauci about this. But now that I've told you what the price is, $2,300 up to $3,100, here's the kicker. How much does it cost to produce each vial? Ready, everyone? Do the math. It cost $1. Let me repeat this.
Wow.
It cost $1 to produce a vial of Remdesivir. Here's the other kicker. Taxpayers also paid for the drug's NIH trial. So the National Institution of Health, the trial was paid by you and me through our tax dollars. It cost $1 a vial, and they are going to be selling it to people who are desperately ill. And what this guy writes, borderline criminal drug pricing. This is evil. But I think they should take over the Remdesivir by eminent domain. They should take it over and say, this is not a time you gouge. And if they gouge on Remdesivir, they're going to gouge on the vaccine. And if they gouge on Remdesivir, they're going to gouge on testing. And any other thing that comes up, this is outrageous. This is not a time to make a profit, Big Pharma. This is a time to be humble.
Well, it is typical behavior. Remember the pharma bro, the guy that raised the price of drugs for, I think, AIDS? He was mocked and he was shunted and eventually thrown in jail for some other thing that he did. But the American people are not very well, I think, informed about how their healthcare system operates. I'm not sure most Americans will ever hear what you just reported because the media doesn't cover it. Why? Have you ever watched TV? Almost all of the advertising on television are pharmaceutical companies. You know, the television and cable isn't going to go after them. Newspapers, Arnie, they're dead. Newspapers are dying everywhere around the country. In Des Moines, the Des Moines Register, a big famous newspaper, is down to where you send an editorial or a letter to one of their top editors, and you get back an email that says, I'm sorry, I'm temporarily on forced leave because of financial difficulties. So how does the American public find out about these things? How?
I'm going to be honest with you. Okay, so you know I'm a progressive liberal Democrat, okay? Yeah. And Democrat is actually the hardest word for me to say. Progressive and liberal, it ain't hard for me to say. And you are seeing the rise of progressives. One of the things that you know about them, and you know people like me, we are squeaky. We are noisy. We talk crazy. I mean, I've got the Secretary of State probably ready to shoot me about what he did with the absentee balloting in New Hampshire because he basically created a flaw. He actually, this is unbelievable, Stefan. When you apply for an absentee ballot, which we now, the governor and the Secretary of State has said that, you know, fear of contracting COVID is a disability. So when you apply for an absentee ballot, Stefan, it says on the application for the ballot that you are concerned about contracting COVID. So you check that box, okay? They send you an absentee ballot. And guess what? The ballot that you sign under penalty of perjury and voter fraud says nothing about COVID. And the only options it gives you is religious observance is why you can't vote in person. It gives you physical disability, or it says you're going to be out of town, out of state. Wow. None of those are true. I am not physically disabled. I am not doing this because of religious observances, and I'm not going to be out of state. So they are asking you to sign under penalty of perjury a lie. And this is the document that you put your ballot in. I have been going bonkers, basically calling out the Secretary of State, calling out the governor. They hate me. Why? Because I'm such a squeaky wheel, and now they're trying to figure out how to shut me down. Because guess what? It's now raising questions about the integrity of the vote that they intentionally did because they sent out two documents that say the opposite things. So again, I'm just going to say that's the opportunity you have through social media where the you know, MSNBC and CNNs get too much money from the pharmaceutical industry. I get nothing. I get nothing. Shut me up. Guess what? You take away nothing. So you can't shut me up. I mean, that's really, that is the truth.
And it's true. And I'll tell you very quickly that in Des Moines, Iowa, a group of young protesters protested so much on Black Lives Matter and on the fact that in Iowa, felons do not automatically, after they do their sentence, get the vote back, the governor has to sign for every single person to give them back their vote. And they squeaked so loud and made so much noise that yesterday, the governor of Iowa, who is Republican, signed an executive order restoring the vote for felons who have completed their sentence.
That is the best story I've heard. That's the best story. I love you, Stefan. But I want people to hear this. You know, there's value to protest. Yeah. There is value to protest. You know what? You can be nice and you can play nice in the sandbox. Mm. They'll pat you on the head. I'm going to end with this. So when I ran for governor in 1991, and I ran in 92, obviously, for the governor's race, I ran against the party chairman and the five-term congressman. Well, when I was a big advocate for changing the tax system and I was going to fight the pledge and I was going to do all these different things. And so I had always been known as that. The party chairman patted me, former party chairman, patted me on the head and basically said, sure, Arnie, whatever you want to do. And I looked at him and I said, you know what I'll do? Pat me on the head. I'll run against you. And he looked at me and he rolled his eyes. And I said, watch. I beat him. I beat him. That was my protest. That was my fighting in the streets. We had more votes in that primary than we ever had in state history. And they just broke that number in 2018, virtually almost 20 years later. That is a form of protest. Just what you told me about what the Republican governor had to sign, that is a form of protest. Sometimes playing nice in the sandbox is to be buried in the sandbox. You know what? You got to get out of the sandbox. So last but not least, we're looking at the whole idea of teachers and opening schools. Yeah. 8 out of 10 teachers basically said they're terrified. They're really worried about it. And we just heard from Scott Braddock that 40% of the teachers in Texas could actually retire. They're eligible for retirement. If that doesn't send a message to school districts between the fear that you saw in the poll and the 40% that could retire in Texas, and I'm sure the number is probably very high around the country, sure. I'm just wondering, should we even have another school year? Someone described that what we should do for this 2021 is make it a universal gap year.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that education doesn't happen, but it's the COVID year. It's not the year that you matriculate. It's not the year that you have to sort of take those tests to make sure you go from 11th grade to 12th grade. We're going to call it the COVID year.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. And I think parents and community organizations can provide all kinds of educational experiences to fill that in.
I mean, education, everyone thinks that education is a test. Everyone thinks that education is an A or a B or a C or a D. There are ways to keep kids still engaged, keep their skills up, maybe even expand their skills, but not through a traditional learning process, and don't expect to do that. It doesn't make sense. Not this year. It's not good for the economy. It's not good for parents. It's not good for kids. And it's clearly not good for schools and teachers.
Well, and what you just said is this. Education and schooling are two different things. Schooling is going to school. Education, I met a guy in Colombia, South America, when I was doing my research for my PhD. He had less than a high school education, never graduated from high school. He was a librarian. He knew more about politics, about economics. He referred me to people. He was the most educated person without schooling that I've ever met. He was unbelievable. He did it all himself. He loved to read. His parents loved to teach him. He was a self-made man. And we can all do that. And it doesn't matter if you're poor, there's somebody in your community who is wonderful, brilliant, who can teach you about history. You know, you can be urban or suburb, and there are a thousand things that you can learn about nature. You can go and do nature walks and figure out what's going on out there. Those are all education.
I got to share a story that happened two or three years ago. I'm on the air, and one of our board members for our radio station is there. She's a very successful businesswoman. I'm incredibly successful. Susan Bruce, you know, my former producer, and Scott Braddock, okay, of the Quorum Report. We were talking about exactly what you were talking about. Do you know that of the four of us, because there were four of us in the room, the only person who had graduated from high school and gone to college was me.
Wow.
Let me just repeat that. Now, those three of those people, not me, are actually more brilliant than me. They're more well-read than me. They know more than me. It was not because they got a piece of paper. It was not because they graduated from college or they went to law school or they even got a high school diploma. So I just want people to know that as we are so frightened about what this means academically, it doesn't have to be a wash. It isn't about not learning. And I want to defend the teachers that are afraid. I want to figure out how to do something for schools. I want employers to be receptive to the idea that it's going to be a real challenge for people to have their kids home. And frankly, at the college level, I don't know what they're going to do, because not only are people afraid about how you open schools up at the university level, but they're also afraid that schools are now going to be super spreader events in their community.
Sure.
It's not even just about having them come back. It's what does it mean to the community to destabilize them from the purposes of the pandemic.
No, that's right. And, you know, we see that around the world where countries have opened schools and suddenly outbreaks happen, they have to shut them down again. So this is going to be a challenging process where educators, teachers, school board members, principals ought to be given more flexibility to basically adjust how they serve their constituents, which is students and their families.
Absolutely.
I think in some cases where the Iowa governor is rigidly, completely, I guess, compulsive about having schools reopen with kids in them. She is saying, no, you cannot have just virtual schools, and it has to be 50% at least in the classroom. And, you know, there is a huge pushback to that in Iowa by parents, by teachers, by community leaders. I think we're seeing a revival of grassroots power and participation, which I think is an interesting experiment for us as a country.
Exactly. And before I let you go, we only have a minute left. And that is, do you have a mask mandate in Iowa?
No.
No. Well, we don't have a mask mandate in New Hampshire. No, so let me just tell you who just voted for a mask mandate. Hanover, New Hampshire, and Durham, New Hampshire.
Sure.
Hanover, New Hampshire, everyone, is the home of Dartmouth College. Mm-hmm. Durham is the home of the University of New Hampshire.
Right.
Here's the problem. If they just have a mask mandate for their community, their town, yeah, it doesn't help. Because kids live outside the town, because people commute outside the town. So once again, they're trying to do something by defining a mask mandate before their kids come back to school. But when they're not islands. They're not islands. They're within a bigger setting. And as your governor has punted, my governor has punted. Oh, thank you so much, Stefan Schmidt. Stefan Schmidt teaches at the University of Iowa State at Ames, affectionately known as Dr. Politics. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Stefan. All right, everyone. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. We'll talk to you next week. Ciao. You just